going as well as they're going. We're talking about the love of God and the difficulty of explaining to ourselves, as we're getting ourselves to get it, how much He loves us. And it's saying that it's been shown to us through this very strange relationship between Hosea and Gomer. It's saying that there was something unequal in that relationship, that this is a relationship between a prostitute and a prophet, and that he was told, chapter 3, verse 1, to go and love her, not just act out a kind of a marriage, but to love her according to the love of God for his people Israel. And within chapter 1 to 3, you've got Hosea's marriage with Gomer and the situation of the children. She goes to the shrine of the idol as a prostitute, gets pregnant, has children, lies to Hosea, and yet he holds the babies in his arms and says, these are not my people. And in the same way, God was married to Israel, but Israel went to the idols and worshipped the idols. So Hosea's mother to Gomer, and Gomer goes to the to the shrine, so they worship the idols, and gets pregnant. And we're talking about the pain of God as it's reflected in the pain of Hosea. And the way that God is not as sort of non-human as we might imagine him to be, but that actually he has very real feelings, and that he's not so totally separate from us in that sense, that he can limit himself. Just as if you go into a relationship where one person, for example, is much more wealthy or much more clever or more educated or more wealthy than the other one, there has to be a genuine power sharing between them for the thing to work. Now that's what God's done to us, with us, and it's what Hosea did with Gomer. And so in that sense, God can limit, as it were, his knowledge, his power, so that he feels it all happening in real time. We spoke about the parable, surely they will reverence my son. They don't. The implication is the father is hit hard by this shock that, well, they didn't respect my son, they killed my servants, and they killed my son. And that this is how it is with God. They're saying that Hosea, it's up on the screen there, ministered for about 50 years or so, which meant that he spent his whole lifetime, really, living out this terrible, painful relationship with this woman. And they're saying that God is like the young man who falls in love with this woman, he's telling her all about himself. She's not really listening, not really interested, and then she goes off with other men. She takes his name in vain, and we said that to take God's name in vain refers to what would have been understood as an idiom for marriage, to take the name of a man upon yourself, and she took it in vain in the sense that she got in a relationship, she wasn't really bothered about it, fussed about it, and that seems to be the number one difficulty, temptation for Mr. Delkins and this generation, to take the name in vain. They get involved in the relationship with this wonderful God of love, and yet be zoned out, and be sort of out there, and not reading this word for the love letter to us, for the loving self-revelation to us that it really is. And we spoke of how God stuck this for centuries with Israel, but then he found another woman. And that woman is us. And we closed the last session by by resolving all of us that I, no matter how much everyone else has messed up, that I will do my very best for him, to be his faithful woman, to be the one who Israel should have been, but they weren't. And we all, I'm sure, resolve in our heart that although I would almost rather not be in this situation in the sense that I wish I'm not such a good person, I wish God had not fallen in love with me, but he has, so I will do my very best. And I will really, almost motivated by the awful experience God's had with Israel, just like Hosea had with Gomer, we'll try our very best to do all we can, as it were, to be as we should be, because he, as it were, deserves it. So I want to go from there to develop some other reflections that come out of us. One is that God
is in search of man, the quota
rabbi.
It's not as if, well, there's God up there, sort of indifferently existing, and we're kind of searching for God. You know, somebody might say, well, I've searched for God for 10 years and I found it. Oh, I was in search of the truth. Ah, I found it. No, that might be true to some extent. But my point is that the biblical emphasis is the other way, that God is in search of man. I see a line, like grapes in the wilderness, I found Israel. Like the first fruit on the fig tree in its first season, I saw your father. This is the image is when a man is looking on his fig tree as the season is approaching. Where's the first fruit? Ah, here it is. I saw it. He's looking every day, going, I'm glancing at his fig tree, and I see the beginning of the fruit, and there it is. He found him in a desert land, and in the howling waste of the wilderness, God. He encircled him, he cared for him, he kept him as the apple of his eye. You know, the apple of your eye, in the sense of Solomon, the human body. God found Israel in the wilderness. And we said that in the same way as God told Israel to go marry a prostitute, and he did that and loved her, knowing that she would be unfaithful to him, as God said she would be. So it seems to me that that's how it was with God and Israel. But he knew what they were going to be like, but he still loved her in the wilderness. We said that they came out of Egypt carrying the tabernacle of Moloch and the staff of their god, Yom-Pan. But they came out carrying two tabernacles, the one of Yahweh and the one of Moloch, and that they had all their idols cuddled up in their coats and in their packs as they came out of Egypt and walked through the Red Sea. And that there in the wilderness they were hardly really loving God. They were there simply because they were scared of Egypt and there was no way back, so they went forward. So they went through the Red Sea and so they took down the wilderness. And yet God was so positive about them. I found you there in the desert. And I fell in love with you, as it says in Ezekiel. Now, let's take some real encouragement from this. I'm not anti-Semitic. I'm not against Jewish people. I'm from Jewish background myself. But what I'm saying is that Israel has hardly been faithful to God. You couldn't actually have worse example than Israel for rebellion against God. And yet, for that tiny little bit of spirituality that was in Israel, that tiny little bit, God got crazy. I should have put the verse up from Ezekiel there, where he says how he fell in love. I saw you as a such beautiful woman in the wilderness, and I spread my skirt over you, and I loved you. You think, what? With that love, what, you know, came out of Egypt with their idol, and only came out because, well, they were going to die if they stayed there. And God got so crazy about them in the wilderness. When they were in the wilderness with their tabernacle of Moloch being on their shoulders, as well as his, with the stars of their gods, and oh, you were beautiful. Now, the point of encouragement is this. If God felt like that to Israel, now, don't want to give the impression that, we as the ecclesia of today are so much better than Israel, but we also should not underestimate the fact that we have seriously committed our lives and staked our life on the Son of God, that he existed, that he died, and he rose from the dead. We all believe that. We staked our lives on that. If that's how much God could fall for Israel, how much more does he fall for us in love to have accepted his Son? And let's not underestimate the pleasure that we give God. We've spoken a lot about sin. I'll never get the balance right. None of us can, I suppose. You can't just keep on about awfulness of human sin. You can't just shut your eyes to it and say, I've got his love. But somewhere between those two is this true position. And you can never hold it directly in your feelings correctly. You're either too over-positive or too negative. And we can never quite express it in words. That doesn't matter, as long as you recognize that. My point is that we are touching the heart of God with joy. So often, just when you make that decision, it can be to pour another brother or sister a cup of coffee, or, oh, I see she's left her cup there, oh, well, I'll pick that up and take it to the table. from the small things to the bigger things. We are touching the heart of God. As I said in my first talk, when we please God, there is no, you know, so a happy sun comes out with a big smile on it and all that. And when we do something wrong, there is no lightning. Unless God's very pleased with Queensland and sunshine and coastal and anywhere else. It seems to me that, not. And that's the whole challenge of faith. That it's not like that. But God is not so incredible to be like that. And yet that does not mean that he is not there feeling these things. I think it's one of the great joys of actually being in the kingdom when we will see with different eyes and we will understand and be able maybe to look back, like sort of total recall, go back into your life and see how we cut God up and how we made him happy. Now, that arises out of that thing about God being so thrilled to find Israel in the wilderness. But it's not just that. In Psalms, I have found David my servant. He was looking for a man. And then Jeremiah 5, God says to Jeremiah in the spirit, in the idea that Jeremiah is to manifest God, run to and fro to the streets of Jerusalem. Look and take note. Search her square to see if you can find a man. One who does justice and seeks truth that I may pardon her. Incidentally, I think that is the prophecy of Messiah. That this is right back in those times. God through his prophets was looking for a man, for the man, for whose sake God should pardon Zion. That's important. My point is that God was represented by Jeremiah running. He was to run all around the streets of Jerusalem, looking, to search around the squares, the open places, the parks, as we'd say today. Can you find a man? God is in search of man. And so the tragedy was, God said, there was no man. I looked and there was nobody. I called, nobody answered. I spread out my hands all the day to a rebellious people. And we spoke earlier about the tragedy of God, that God almost becomes a tragic figure, that his love was so great, so bubbled up, as it were, wanting to be poured out to Israel, searching, and they didn't respond. Just like Hosea was looking, and these terms occur throughout Hosea, he was looking for Gomer to come back, but she didn't. And so, when we do meet God, as it were, that's why the whole cosmos is electric, Jesus says, that when one sinner repents, that there is this rejoicing in heaven. There is this God that searches, and he finds someone, they find him. There's this meeting. And yeah, this really does inspire us, not only to return, as it were, to God ourselves, to repent as soon as we can after we fail. That's one practical thing that comes out. Even if it means pulling your car over, turning off the engine and sorting it, or whatever. In our minds, with our eyes open or whatever. But also to motivate us to preach, I think, to Israel particularly, but to all people. So that at least one other person, because of what we've tried to do, will turn to God. So that this God whose love is so great that he's searching, running around in the streets, as it were, looking for the person that he can enter a relationship with, so that at least he finds one more. That's, of course, the joy of a baptism. Now, I want to talk a little bit about what exactly Gomer was doing so terribly wrong. And we said that, you know, she was not a prostitute because she didn't have money. We said that Gomer Bat Diblaim could be a title for a temple prostitute, and we said that Gibla occurs in Hosea 3 verse 1 translated raisin cake, which is what they used at the idol shrine. Now, it seems to me that Hosea married Gomer, and he married an observant Jewess, that she was, in that sense, keeping the law, and yet she was also worshipping these idols. And she represented Israel. And this is God's whole complaint with Israel, that he loved Israel, and they said they loved him, but they also worshipped other gods. The pain of it all was not that Israel walked out on God and said, we don't want Yahweh as our God, we want to have Moloch, we want to have this one or that one. They said, we love you. This is like God's whole complaint all through Hosea. You say that you love me. You say that you know me. You call upon me, but you are far from me. And we said that Hosea 1 to 3 about Hosea's marriage is really not to be divorced from the rest of the prophecy about God and Israel. And you can read them back from how God speaks to Israel about what's going on in Hosea's marriage. And on that basis, I imagine that Gomer was continually telling him, Hosea, how much she loved him, when quite obviously she was out with other men. There's a big theme in Hosea of how Israel lies to God, reflecting how Gomer would have lied to Hosea. And therefore, the real problem with Israel was not that they left God, but that they worshipped other things in the name of God. Now, you'll notice that we read, when we read through those chapters in Hosea, that God looks forward to the day, this is Hosea 2, verse 16, that you will call me Ishai, that you will call me husband, and you will no longer call me Baal. What seems to have happened was that the people of Israel were worshipping Baal and justifying that as a form of worshipping Yahweh. They were saying, well, yeah, we worship Yahweh, and, well, on the quiet, secretly, we'll go and worship Baal. And, well, we feel very bad about it, but, well, we'll do it because it's enjoyable. It wasn't quite that primitive. They were saying, yeah, we worship Yahweh, and now we go worship Baal, and that's a form of worshipping Yahweh. And that's why they had no conscience about it. And I'd like to look in a little bit more detail in the later chapters of Hosea to exemplify this. If you look at Hosea 9, verse 11, Hosea 10, verse 5, my apologies, Hosea 10, verse 5, talking about how the people of Samaria worship the calves of Beth-Aven, the priests thereof rejoiced on it, for the glory is departed from it. Now, this idea of glory is a word that's usually used about the glory of God, of Yahweh, that departs. But it says here that these calves had these idolatrous calves had their own glory, as if the worship of the calves was related to a form of the worship of God. Certain chapter 7, verse 16, chapter 7, verse 16, I got that reference wrong. There's just a reference to the idol somewhere as El, but the word is normally translated God. And yet it's used about the idols as well as about God.
Verse 9 of chapter 11? No?
Just the words of the idols, the words that are used to describe the idols in Hosea are similar to the words that are used to describe God. That's my point. There's one that's called S-R, you know, there's no vowels in biblical Hebrew people. S-R, and that's the same with consonants as, well, with the vowels pointing in Sur, which is translated the rock. Yahweh is a rock. And that's one of the idols is called, is the rock. We're told in Hebrews 12, sorry, I've taken these references out of the Russian Bible and the French have it up in English. You might know that the word kadosh in Hebrew means holiness, and another title of the idols is the kedoshim, the holinesses. Anyway, my point is, I'm sorry to make a bit of a mess there, but my point is that the very words that are used to describe the idols in Hosea are the words that are used to describe God. That was my point. The other thing that I found reading around this is that at the time of Hosea and before that, there's actually very little evidence of idols of totally separate idols, places for worshipping idols existing in Israel and Judah. It seems that from the inscriptions that the high places where the idols are worshipped were really places of Yahweh worship. So it seems to me that they were worshipping the idols as a form of Yahweh worship. And why I think that's significant is because it goes back to Gomer's relationship to Hosea, that she was saying, yes, I love you, I'm your husband. Sorry, I'm your wife. But I am completely justified in going after these other men. But this is, in a sense, what I have to do to bring blessing to us. And that's what Israel were doing with these idols. But they thought they could worship them as a form of worshiping Yahweh. And that is our temptation. But how is it our temptation? Well, here's some examples. We might think, we all like to gossip. So I don't like it, but we all, humanly speaking, like to gossip. Think, oh, should I tell Brother so-and-so about what I saw Sister so-and-so doing? We weigh it up in our minds, and we think, oh yeah, I should. Because actually he ought to know. Actually he ought to know, because it could be good for her spiritually, he ought to know. And you tell him what you saw her doing, and then you realize that later that was gossip. But at the moment, in the heat of the moment, you thought, no, that was for love. Or you think, no, we've got to uphold God's truth. We all heard that phrase of the 12th. We've got to uphold God's truth, like we need to uphold it. We've got to uphold God's truth by doing this, or by doing that, or by writing a horrible letter to somebody, or being mean to somebody. And later on you realize, that wasn't fine, that was the flesh. What I'm saying is that most of our sins that we commit are not acts of rebellion, whereby we say, well, I've had it, God, I'm going to do what I want to do, and I don't care what you want to do. We're not looking like that. Like Israel, we want to go away from Yahweh, and so we don't want a relationship with you. We act in a fleshly way under the guise of spirituality. I look around at us here, and I don't think any of us here are committing what the world would consider to be the big sin. Yeah, we're all sinning. And probably for us, the sort of way we sin is when the flesh and spirit get mixed together. As I say, a bit of gossip, a bit of unkind suggestion, and at the time thinking, this is done in love. I'm doing this in love, in concern, in worry for this person, and later you realize, no, it's not right at all. That is, it seems to me, how we fail. And that is our equivalent of what they were doing. So Israel departed from God in the same way Gomer departed from Hosea, but she didn't physically, I don't think, leave him. It was a mental thing. And we're told that Gomer departed, he said, she has departed from me, she has walked away from me. And in Hosea 7, God uses that same word to describe how Israel departed to Assyria to try and get help. That's in Hosea 7, verse 11. Ephraim calls to Egypt and goes to Assyria. It's the word return. They go down to Assyria. They depart to Assyria to get help in the time of their invasion. They depart to Assyria to get help. That's the same word used about Gomer departing from Hosea. What's the connection? The idea is that Israel trusting in human strength was as bad as Gomer departing from Hosea, even though I suggested she didn't physically end the relationship, she went off to the island. So what's the lesson there? When we got a problem, lump appeals on our body, car won't start, problems in employment, whatever it is, we're tempted, aren't we, to immediately run to human help. And if that fails, we pray to God. That's what Israel were like, and Judah were like. They departed off to Assyria to try to get help. They called to Egypt to try to get help. And that's the same word as Gomer departed from Hosea. Now we might not think that that's particularly bad to trust in human strength. We may think that that's perfectly normal. But for God, that breaks his heart. Now we don't like, of course, our sinfulness and our weakness being likened to prostitution. We think that's over the top. It's like if you get stopped and fined or whatever for driving, let's say, 60 zone, you think, well, yeah, I was on the wrong side of the law, but that's ridiculous. Or the other day I was lost in Sydney and this guy was calling me because I didn't indicate as to what exit I was going to take on the roundabout. And you get that feeling, well, there's nothing really wrong with what I did. It's a little technical slip-up. That's ridiculous. You're just this unreasonable. Don't worry about it. Don't think that this fellow's unreasonable. And unfortunately, we take that attitude right through our lives, spiritually. I might be human. Whereas we are hurting God. And we spoke in our first talk about a terrible hurt of God. And reading some background stuff on Hosea, I was very impressed with one thing that I read. It was talking about how women were totally subservient to men in those days. They simply belonged to the man. And the man, the Hebrew male, feared women in only one sense. They feared that a woman could disgrace them. That in other words, if their woman went away from them and committed adultery, they were disgraced in the eyes of the village and the eyes of their society. And so the Hebrew male feared his woman in the sense that he feared that she might bring disgrace to him. And this is how it would have been for Hosea. The shame of the fact that he made such a fool of, as it were, by this woman. We said that he sold everything up, he paid partly in cash, partly in kind to get this woman. He multiplied her silver and gold, he gave her everything. And she blew it down at the idol shrine. She acted there as an unashamed temple prostitute. And he was made an absolute fool of. Shame in the Semitic culture is a very, very huge thing. And he was made a fool of and ashamed in the eyes of his society. There's a passage in Jeremiah 8 where Jeremiah weeps for how God is being put to shame. Not in front of just a Palestinian village, but in front of the whole cosmos by what Israel was doing to him. So Hosea, like any Hebrew male, would have been very, very ashamed and would have felt that his whole manhood was at stake because of what this woman had done to him. His whole manhood was at stake. And we read in Hosea chapter 2 how angry Hosea was. How, and part of that anger, I think, came from his sense of shame, even though he knew in ahead of time that she was going to do this. Yet when she actually did it, he kind of couldn't believe it. And so in the same way as his manhood was at stake, you could say that God's sort of godhood, if you like, is at stake over Israel. And it is at stake over us. And we said that Hosea was particularly sensitive about the way that he had provided for her absolutely everything, but she did not appreciate that. We read in Hosea 2, verse 5, that Gomer said, Hosea 2, verse 5, I will go after my lovers that gave me bread, water, wool, flax, linen, oil, and drink. Now, according to the Binnen commentaries, those very things there, bread, water, wool, flax, that is linen for clothing, oil and drink, these are listed in contemporary documents that existed around that time as the duties of marriage, that a husband had a duty to provide his wife with those very things. The duty of a husband was to provide for his wife. She was to look after the home and raise the kids. But in their culture, she was not to go out and get bread and water and clothes and oil and drink from anybody else. He was to provide it. It was a shame on him if he didn't. Now, this terrible Gomer was going after these lovers of hers, and they were giving her all these things. That was the insult to Hosea, that they were giving her the very things that it was his duty as a husband to give her. But she didn't want to take them from him. She wanted to take them from these terrible men she was mixing with. And that's why, well, when he says, verse 5, that this Gomer has done shamefully, I think it could be meaning she had shamed me. Because the shame was actually more on him than on her. And every sin that God's people commit, God's covenant people, every sin and failure that we commit, brings this shame upon God. And it struck me very strongly once, sitting on the number 5 tram in Riga, and this phrase came into my head, God is at stake. God is at stake. Now, I almost wanted to get a pen and write it on the seat that's in front of me, on the back of the seat. God is at stake. Say to the woman next to me, you know what? God is at stake. And it's not just that I could sin. That's what I started off thinking. Well, I'm thinking quite simply, don't sin. Don't fail your God anymore. Because God himself is at stake. Because of how much he's staked on you. But then you go wider than that. I think it's a tragedy that any of God's people sin. It's a tragedy that, you know, if we see our brother or our sister walking away, losing it, acting as they should not, shaming God, God is at stake. And in the same way, Hosea was incredibly shamed by her, by Gomer. This is what God's people can do to God. And again, looking at the flip side, how much joy, therefore, God has to finally meet a people who are not going to do that to him, that we're not going to bring him shame. We are going to be sons that make him proud. You remember how God lamented about Israel. I thought, after she has done all this, she will return to me. But she did not. I thought how I would set you among my sons. This is God imagining how he's going to be the proud father. I thought you would call me my son. But no. As a faithless wife leaves her husband, so you have been faithless to me, your house of Israel. So that's one side of it. But the flip side is that finally, we as God's little boys and girls are the boys and girls that he's going to be, and is, I believe, proud of. Absolutely. That's how much we can touch God's heart. And it's all going to be, you know, if a movie could be made of this, it would be the wonderful guy who marries the worthless prostitute and pours everything into her and can't make it work and reveals himself to her, bears his soul to her as God has done in his self-revelation in the Bible, and she doesn't want to know. And finally, it all falls apart, and then he finds someone else who's also not completely good, but who vows to make up for what that woman did. In a very crude analogy, but it's extremely crude, Bill and Melinda Gates. World's richest man, married to this, what I see, sort of a woman of his level, and there they are, prancing around the world with all their money and all their good works. Let's imagine that went wrong, that she goes and betrays him and is mean to him and awful, and he carries on, and she's there maybe as a drug addict or a hooked gambler maybe, spending all his money, and everyone would sort of feel a bit sorry for the guy, betraying him, and then divorce, and then he marries this illiterate kid from Africa. That's the sort of thing that's happened between God and us. We like the little kid from Africa, who maybe can't even read, doesn't know what a computer is, let alone Windows, and she's married to Bill. And he's got a power share with her. Maybe she does mess up a bit, or maybe she doesn't quite get it right. But she loves him, and she's going to be his faithful man. And it's a bit of an odd relationship, and they won't go around the world again. But that's the crude analogy, but that's how it is with us and God, so it seems to me. Now, we said that our sin is like her or Gomer's prostitution. And I don't like to particularly dwell on this, but it jumps out at you as you read Hosea that this woman is, or was, what I would call sexually addicted. Let's just go through some of them. This is chapter 4, verse 18. She, Israel, committed whoredom continually. Now I said chapter 1 to 3 is Hosea's story with Gomer, and chapter 4 to the end is God's story with Israel, but the two sections are divorced because everything you read about God's relationship with Israel, you can relate back to Hosea and Gomer. So, Israel committed whoredom continually. At 5 verse 4, the spirit of whoredom is in the midst of them. The attitude to be a prostitute is in the midst of them. Chapter 7, verse 4 and verse 7, they are adulterers like an oven getting hotter and hotter. That's them. Chapter 8, verse 9, Ephraim has hired lovers. This is someone who's that sexually addicted. This is the prostitute who pays money to men to sleep with her. And of course, that goes back to chapter 2, verse 8, if you're making this, that Hosea gave Gomer silver and gold, which she gave to Baal. She took his bit of money down there to the idol sanctuary. So this woman is addicted. We're told in chapter 2, verse 12, that it seems that men paid Gomer to sleep with her. But also, here from chapter 8, verse 9, she used that money to pay other men to sleep with her. In the context of sexual sin, chapter 13, they sin, commit adultery more and more. Well, that's maybe quite enough of that. But my point is that this woman was addicted. She was sexually addicted. And this is a picture of human sin. That really is cumulative. And this is where there's a difference between the Holy Spirit and the evil spirit. And I understand the two things simply like this. So there's an upward spiral and a downward spiral. And God is waiting to confirm us. Every act of righteousness we do, he's willing to, or attitude of righteousness, God confirms that. And that's what I call the Holy Spirit. Every weakness, every act of rebellion, God is waiting there to confirm us, to push us down that spiral. That's what's going on. And that's why we can never take a break in our relationship from God. You can't like, have a holiday. You can't say, I will stay, I'm not playing the game. That we push one way or the other, up or down, that spiral. And so this is what was going on with Israel. They were getting more and more insatiable. And it seems that Israel, in a sense, came to hate God in the same way as Gomer came to hate Hosea. He talks about the hatred which they practiced in the house of their God, in chapter 9. Reflecting it back on Gomer in the house of her master or her husband, there was a hatred for him in her heart. And then in chapter 9, we read that Israel were given a miscarrying womb and dry breath. And again, I relate that back to Hosea and Gomer, that she became infertile. She had a miscarrying womb. It's not surprising if she lived in the promiscuous way she did, but she would have become barren. And so, from a Hebrew male point of view, she was totally unattractive now as a proposition. She couldn't have any more children. And yet, even then, let's have a look at chapter, I think you know that verse, yeah, it's in chapter 9, from verse 12 to 15, where it says that Israel will be given a miscarrying womb and dry breath. But let's go on to chapter 14, verse 8. Just, I think, the almost tear-jerking climax to the whole thing. God says a strange thing, apparently, chapter 14, verse 8. From me is your fruit found. From me is your fruit found. This is the woman who has the dry breasts and the miscarrying womb. In God, chapter 14, verse 3, the fatherless finds mercy. And as I say, in the final end, this woman would have been so unattractive, but still Hosea wanted her. And it's the same with Israel. They became barren completely. And yet, God, through some sort of miracle, wanted to have them back. Now, this is his love. And if it's his love for Israel, then how much more is it his love for us? Then finally, chapter 14, verse 9, I think it's a challenge to us all in the end. Who is wise, and he shall understand these things, prudent, and he shall know them. The ways of the Lord are right, and the just shall walk in them, the transgressors shall fall therein. Again, that's the idea of an upward or downward spiral. But if you've got the ways of God, the just walk in them. But the transgressors, by trying to walk in them, fall in them. And so that's sort of the challenge to us then in verse 9. Who is wise and he will understand this? Who's going to look back at this book of Hosea and see the story and work it all out and understand that this was God's relationship with Israel. This is his eternal love for them, as he protests really in chapter 14, that he will in the end, verse 4, love them freely. And his anger will be turned away from them. After all that Gomer had done, this was Hosea's fantasy for Gomer, and this was God's fantasy for Israel. And this will be the joy of God's kingdom, that finally his fantasy to love in the end all of us and save in the end all of his people will finally come true. And yet we can't be passive to that. Hosea's fantasy for Gomer didn't come. And in the first instance, God's fantasy for Israel didn't work out. But when he says in verse 1, chapter 14, of Israel, return to the Lord thy God, I've been said in the first talk, but really this was all in the context of Israel going into captivity in Babylon. There they were 70 years, they were asked to go back to rebuild the land and in a sense to enter into maybe what could have been God's kingdom on earth. And yet they did not want to. That when Hosea makes a plan to send his wife away, to separate from his wife, to separate her from her lovers for a certain short period, and then remarry with each other, this is was fulfilled in God sending the people to Babylon 70 years. And then he wants them to come back to him. But they don't want to come back to him. We talked in the first talk about the book of Esther, how they were prosperous in Babylon. The numbers of people that returned unto Esther and Nehemiah were pathetic. They didn't want to come back. They preferred a soft life in Babylon. You remember some of them, well, the very poorest of them go back, and the others send back that they sort of financially enable it. They give their money, they give their presents and all that, send the stuff back to the land, supporting from a distance, but they wanted to stay there, unfortunately. And that's the tragedy of the whole thing. But that was the plea of God in Hosea to Israel and Babylon, return. This was Hosea's plea to go. Even though you have miscarrying women as well and dry grass, come back to the land. Come back to me. But they didn't want to. And yet, God has found this other woman. Repeat what I said in my first talk, that that other woman is us. And if we'd have had a choice in that, we would have said nothing. I'm not such a good person. I don't want to be part of this. Just give me 70 years and that's it. But by his grace, he has said, no, I want you. And I've fallen in love with you. And this colossal love of this ultimately passionate God, this God whose love goes on in the fantasy, like this here, fantasizes about Gomer coming back to him, having the outdoor wedding ceremony all over again, and the animals even joining in. This God who has that passionate love and fantasy for us, this dream of living with us in his kingdom, this God has fallen in love with every one of us here. And yeah, this is not something that can be accepted without being felt. That you know, we have to feel this. We cannot just be passive to it. And it's a tragedy to me if all we know of this is the kingdom of God will be on earth, not in heaven. That's the end of it. You know, I'm zoned out now. I'm getting on with my life. These things take our whole life over. They absolutely do. Because this God who is so serious about us demands some sort of response. We're like the girl who suddenly realizes she has the attention of this Bill Gates kind of character with all the money and wealth and wisdom and passion that one could ever think of. And suddenly the penny drops. Actually, he's interested in me. He really is. He's not just being polite to me and being courteous. He's interested in me. And I hope that today, the penny has dropped a lot further with each of us. That he's not only interested in me, he is passionately in love with me. And now that has got to take a grip, a radical and a fundamental grip on our human lives in practice.